All right, let's do it. I don't have a statement. Let's just do it.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for taking questions. Diplomacy depends on predictability, reliability, trust. Markets are crashing around the world for the second day in a row. The consensus is that the president's tariffs were much higher than expected and based on economic formulas that people do not understand. What is your reaction and what is the impact on Europeans? You want them to spend more on defense,
yes,
which they're agreeing to, finally. But how can they do that when their economies are crashing and they are now...
No, their economies are not crashing. Their economies are not crashing. Their markets are reacting to a dramatic change in the global order in terms of trade. And so what happens is pretty straightforward. If you're a company and you make a bunch of your products in China, and all of a sudden shareholders or people that play the stock market realize that it's going to cost a lot more to produce in China, your stock is going to go down. But ultimately, the markets, as long as they know what the rules are going to be moving forward, and as long as that's set and you can sustain where you're going to be, the markets will adjust. Businesses around the world, including in trade and global trade, they just need to know what the rules are. Once they know what the rules are, they will adjust to those rules. So I don't think it's fair to say economies are crashing. Markets are crashing because markets are based on the stock value of companies who today are embedded in modes of production that are bad for the United States. We have to be a country that thinks we're the largest consumer market in the world, and yet the only thing we export is services. And we need to stop that. We need to get back to a time where we're a country that can make things, and to do that, we have to reset the global order of trade.
Term, and the other part of my question.
Well, the worst thing is to leave it the way it is forever. I mean, this is just can't continue. We can't continue to be a country that doesn't make things. We have to be able to make things to provide jobs for Americans. That's it. It's that simple. China, as an example, I mean, it's outrageous. I mean, they don't consume anything. All they do is export and flood and distort markets in addition to all the tariffs and barriers they put in place. So the president rightly has concluded that the current status of global trade is bad for America and good for a bunch of other people, and he's going to reset it, and he's absolutely right to do it.
Let me ask you about also the predictability of relationships with allies. The Prime Minister of Denmark, which at this point owns Greenland, so Denmark, a NATO ally, is saying that it's unacceptable that one country cannot annex another country.
Well, no one's annexed anything. It's going to be up to Greenlanders. The vice president made that clear. He's going to respect the self-determination of Greenlanders. So at some point, you know, the Greenlanders have made clear that they want to be independent of Denmark. Yes, so that's the Greenland. Denmark should focus on the fact that the Greenlanders don't want to be a part of Denmark. That's what they should focus on. We didn't give them that idea. They've been talking about that for a long time. Whenever they make that decision, they'll make that decision. And then what we're not going to do is let China come in now and say, offer them a bunch of money and become, you know, dependent on China.
The president said he would not rule out using military force against Denmark, a NATO ally.
No, he said he would not rule out. No. He said he would not rule out. He said, I'm not going to rule out anything if Greenland is encroached upon by a foreign power like a China or Russia or anybody else. But it doesn't matter because Greenlanders are going to make a decision. They're the ones that want to get away from Denmark. They're the ones that want to be independent. And not us. We didn't come up with that idea. They did. And if they make that decision, then the United States would stand ready, potentially, to step in and say, okay, we can create a partnership with you. We're not at that stage. But that's what the vice president made clear last week in his visit there. His statement was very abundantly clear, that we will respect the self-determination of the people of Greenland. People of Greenland, and they're the ones that want to leave Denmark. That wasn't our idea.
All right, well, second question here. Missy from Washington Post.
Mr. Secretary, I'd like to ask you about the Russia-Ukraine negotiations. Can you give us tell us about the American assessment of the conditions that Russia put forward regarding the Black Sea ceasefire talks? And also, the British and French foreign ministers said this morning that Putin was dragging his feet. Do you agree with that?
Maybe he might be. We don't know yet. We're going to find out fairly soon. I mean, look, here's what the president wanted to do. He wants to end this war, and he wanted to test it very early in his administration. Is it possible to end this war on terms that are acceptable, obviously, to both sides? Because you can't end a war unless both sides agree. And that's what we're in the process of finding out. We will know soon enough, in a matter of weeks, not months, whether Russia is serious about peace or not. I hope they are. It would be good for the world if that war ended. But obviously, we have to test that proposition. So we're working through that process. We had a visitor, that Mr. Kirill was here this week, had a chance to sit down with him. He met with others. He'll take some messages back. And the message is the United States needs to know whether you're serious or not about peace. Ultimately, Putin will have to make that decision. The Russian Federation will have to make that decision. I think the Ukrainians have shown a willingness to enter, for example, into a complete ceasefire to create space for negotiation. At some point here, fairly soon, not 6 months from now, you know, the Russians and Putin will have to make a decision about whether they're serious or peace or not, and I hope they are serious. So it would be good for the world if that war ended.
What is your assessment of the Russian conditions that were put forward? And also, Dmitriev said following his talks with Mr. Witkoff yesterday that the U.S. and Russia might resume direct flights as maybe a confidence-building measure. Do you support that?
I haven't heard anything about direct flights. I can tell you, but I don't know who's going to fly in it because all these people are sanctioned. But I would just tell you that the thing I would point to you is this. We're going to wait and see. The Russians know our position in terms of wanting to end the war. And we will know from their answers very soon whether they are serious about proceeding with real peace or whether this is a delay tactic. It's a delay tactic. The president's not interested in that. If this is dragging things out, President Trump's not going to fall into the trap of endless negotiations about negotiations. We will know soon enough whether or not Russia's serious about peace. If they are, that'll be great. Then we can move towards peace. If they're not, then we'll have to reevaluate where we stand and what we do moving forward about it. But we'll be in no different a position than we are today, or we were when he took office. He wanted to know early in his administration, is peace possible? We're testing to see if the Russians are interested in peace. Their actions, not their words, their actions will determine whether they're serious or not. And we intend to find that out sooner rather than later.
What about their conditions?
Which conditions?
They put forward additional conditions after had the Black Sea.
Yeah, so again, I mean, this is part of the back and forth of these sorts of things. I've had phone calls with foreign leaders, and then I read the readout, and I was like, oh, we said them. You never, they said something to me they never said. I guess that's part of the game in this place or whatever. But look, bottom line is, to me, at the end of the day, what's going to matter here is whether we're going to move towards peace or not. If peace is real, we will know soon enough. If they're not interested in peace, we will know soon enough, and we'll make decisions on the basis. I hope they are real. There are some promising signs. There are some troubling signs. It's not going to be easy. No one ever said this would be easy. But we're going to find out sooner rather than later. And let's just say I'm hopeful. I remain hopeful. I need to be hopeful that peace is possible and that the Russians are serious about peace. We want them to be serious about peace. And hopefully they are. But we'll know sooner rather than later.
Daphne Reuters.
Hi. Sorry, I'm back here.
Your last name's Reuters?
No.
Oh, that's pretty cool. And then how you go ahead.
On the 5% defense spending target, have you received pushback to this idea while you've been here this week? And you mentioned yesterday up to 5% was your language. What do you mean by up to 5%?
Well, I said up to a path up, getting up to 5% at some point. I'm not saying overnight, but to get to that point. We think that's what NATO allies need to be spending for NATO to face the threats that itself has identified and articulated. Here's the good news. The good news is everyone generally, with a couple exceptions, are spending more on defense today than they were 3, 4, 5 years ago. That's positive. That trend needs to continue. So the trend lines are good, but they need to continue. But this is not about spending, okay? This is not about money necessarily. This is about capability. In order for NATO to be stronger, it needs partners that are stronger, okay? The United States commits a lot to NATO and continues to. We are as involved in NATO today as we have ever been. And we intend to continue to be, but it has to be a real alliance. And that means that our alliance partners have to increase their own capabilities. So hopefully two things have led to that. The first is the war in Ukraine, I think, has woken up a lot of people on the continent about real threats and real war. And the other is, I think, the pressure and the statements of President Trump that have been pretty consistent about increasing their spending. So this whole trajectory of more defense spending began, I believe, back in 2017, 2018, under President Trump's first term. We want that trend to continue. And we're hoping when the leaders meet in The Hague that there'll be further and firmer commitments in that direction. I think it's beneficial to the alliance. The stronger our partners in NATO are, the more capable our partners in NATO are, the stronger NATO is. And everybody should be in favor of that.
Just to follow up, so will you try and get the official target as 5% rather than 2%, and will the U.S. commit to 5%?
Sure, we're heading there now. I mean, we're going to have to spend more on national security because we have a global footprint. And that's the point that I think has been made and missed in a lot of places. Okay, the United States has Indo-Pacific alliance obligations as well that we've made. We are currently involved in opening up the Red Sea so that global shipping for everyone, including our European partners, can become possible again. We're engaged in counter-drug and counter-gang interdictions in the Western Hemisphere. There's obviously all sorts of issues going on in different parts of the world, including we're concerned about a resurgence of terrorist cells, whether it's in Africa or in the Middle East. So the U.S. has these global obligations, and we have China that's undergoing the largest, most expansive peacetime military expansion in history. So we need to confront all of these things, and we're engaged in all of those things. So we're going to have to increase defense spending in our country. I think our commitment to NATO isn't just 3% spending of GDP. It's sustained over an extraordinary period of time, and that continues. So look, I think our partners know they need to do more. They've all indicated they want to do more. They've begun to do more, and that trend needs to continue.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned that you met with Kirill Dmitriev as well. In order to stop them from dragging their feet and dragging this on, is there anything that you said, perhaps not threats, but is there anything that you said you wanted to see concretely from the Russian side in order to...
Yes, peace. We want to see peace.
But specifics in terms of getting to this ceasefire first and then the negotiations?
Yeah, I mean, peace means you stop shooting at each other. I mean, it's as simplistic as that. Now, obviously, look, there's all kinds of conditions for a final peace, and you have to work with both sides. And I've said from the beginning, the only way a war ends in a negotiated settlement. If it's not an unconditional surrender, then it is both sides make concessions. We're not going to prejudge what those concessions are because those concessions will depend on what Ukraine will accept and Russia will accept. But we have to make concrete steps towards peace. What we're not interested in, and I'm not accusing them of this, I'm just telling you what we're not interested in is negotiations about negotiations. That we're not going to continue this forever. So none of it was threatening. I think it was more an explanation of this is our timeline, and at some point, it'll be clear whether you want peace or you don't want peace. And that time is coming. It's pretty short. At the same time, as we now have seen, members of Congress have begun to file bills to increase sanctions. So there is going to be growing pressure from Capitol Hill to impose sanctions that we're not going to be able to stop if, in fact, we're not making progress towards peace. All these factors have been explained in the nicest way possible. Hopefully he'll take that message back to Moscow and it'll make clear that we need to begin to see real progress or we'll have to conclude that they're not interested in peace. But let's hope they are because I think it would be better for everyone if they are. Well, we need to hear an answer to this. I mean, we're going to have talks as long as talks are about something. They can't be talks about talks. At the end, you know, I think initially it was important to talk because we hadn't talked to them in a long time. But now we've reached the stage where we need to make progress. And if we're not making progress towards peace, then we have a set of factors that we have to take into account. But hopefully we are going to make progress towards peace. I remain optimistic that we can. It'll be hard, it'll be difficult, but I'm optimistic that we can.
Mr. Secretary, the Myanmar earthquake, I mean, normally in these kind of events, you would have up to 200 Americans with sniffer dogs, special equipment, experts in their field, saving lives on the ground. This has not happened because of the dismantling of U.S.
Well, that and the fact that it's run by a military junta that doesn't like us. So it's hard for us to move around in that country.
I'd say it's these events are always non-political. They went into Syria, for example, in the Turkey-Syria earthquake. So they can't access.
But we're not the government of the world. No, we'll provide humanitarian assistance, just like everybody else does, and we will do it the best we can. But we also have other needs we have to balance that against. We're not walking away from humanitarian assistance. But again, I go back, there's a lot of other rich countries in the world. They should all be pitching in. We're going to do our part. We already have people there. We'll have more people there. We'll help as much as we can. It's not the easiest place to work. Okay, they have a military junta that doesn't like us, doesn't necessarily allow us to operate in that country the way we wanted to. That would have impeded our response no matter what. That said, we are willing to continue to help in the humanitarian crisis. Other countries need to do so as well. China's a very rich country. India's a rich country. There are a lot of other countries in the world, and everyone should pitch in. I don't think it's fair to assume that the United States needs to continue to share the burden, 60-70% of humanitarian aid around the world. We will be in the business of humanitarian aid, but we have other priorities as well that are national interest priorities of the United States, and we're going to align all those to be properly balanced.
But isn't this a diminution of your soft power? I mean, all of the experts in this have said the reason is not because of the politics in Myanmar, but it's because of the dismantling of USAID. You simply couldn't deploy.
Yeah, I don't listen to these so-called experts. There's not real experts. These are so-called experts. These are people that are part of that NGO industrial complex. No, these are people that made millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in these NGOs all over the world that stand up and they get flooded with U.S. taxpayer money. And then we have to spend $100 million to get $10 million to people. We're not doing that anymore. OK, okay? We have stopped. We are no longer going to spend $100 million to get $10 million to recipients. We're not going to fund these global NGOs all over the world that are living off of this. We're not doing it. We are prepared to help and work with governments and appropriate NGOs on the ground that are delivering assistance. We will be there and we will be helpful. There are a lot of other rich countries. They should also pitch in and help. And some of them are and some of them are not. But we are going to do our part. We're going to continue to do our part. But it's going to be balanced with all of the other interests we have as a country. We are not a nation. We are the richest country in the world, but our resources are not unlimited. They are not unlimited. And we have a massive national debt, and we have many other priorities as well. And it's time to recalibrate all of that. So we'll be there. We'll be helpful as much as we can. We've got other things we have to take care of as well. But we care deeply about what's happened there. And we wish we had a more cooperative government.
Mr. Secretary, the Middle East was part of your discussion here in NATO, especially that you find support from members toward your policy of airstrikes and Houthis, and your maximum pressure policy toward Iran?
Yeah, I mean, on the Houthis, everybody wants to get their ships through the Red Sea. We're the only ones doing anything about it, but everyone wants to, you know, get their ships through there. As I said, we've done the world a great favor by taking on this band of criminals who have, unfortunately, sophisticated weaponry that they can use to, I mean, they've attacked, what, 150, 160 merchant vessels, 174 times they've attacked the United States Navy. So I think the world should be grateful to the United States for being involved in this and doing this. Everyone thanks us for it. I understand these nations have limited capabilities despite being very rich countries. Nobody else can project power there and do this. But that said, we think that mission is going to bear fruit, and it's necessary. We can't have a band of criminals controlling that. In the case of Iran, I don't know of any country in the world that's excited about Iran ever having a nuclear weapons capability. Some are more forceful about it than others. We've had talks about that. As you know, the president would like to figure out what's going to happen there. But he's also made it clear that there's not going to be a nuclear-armed Iran. That's not going to happen under his watch.
Mr. Secretary, what's your message to foreign citizens who may be afraid to come to the United States because they're concerned about potentially being detained over some minor administrative error, because they might have something on their phone, like criticism of the president or of the Israel-Gaza conflict?
No, first of all, those people that have their phones looked at and so forth, and you know, you'll have to, I'll refer you to CBP to go through their processes. But generally, it's people that have been flagged coming in for a reason. I would say that if you're not coming to the United States to join a Hamas protest or to come here and tell us about how right Hamas is, or to tell us about, you know, stir up conflict on our campuses and create riots in our street and vandalize our universities, then you have nothing to worry about. But thousands and thousands of people come into the U.S. every single day to conduct business, to travel, to do all sorts, to visit relatives. It happens every day. It's very commonplace, and nobody has a problem. I mean, if you're coming here to create problems, you're probably going to have a problem, and I think that's a good thing. If you're coming here to create problems, not here, to the United States, you're probably going to have a problem, yeah. We're not going to continue to be stupid enough to let people into our country who are coming here to tear things up. Not going to happen.
Mr. Secretary, have the Russians done anything concrete to make you encouraged that they are truly interested in peace? And when you talk about timeline, I know you're not going to give a specific timeline, but are you talking weeks or are you talking months?
I think we're talking weeks, probably, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot that has to happen here in the next few weeks in order for this to be real. In terms of concrete, they've agreed to certain things. I mean, I think their things are not striking now that they were before. Obviously, both sides claim that the ceasefire is being violated, as typical of ceasefires like this. But that said, not concrete in terms of, are we closer to peace? We're closer to peace simply because we're talking to both sides, but we're not closer to peace because we have a deal on our hands to end this conflict. But we're going to know soon enough. That's my point I make everybody. You know, people come, oh, well, Putin, you can't trust him. It's not about trusting Putin, not about trusting anybody. This is about actions. If you're interested in peace, you stop fighting. And you lay out the conditions by which you're willing to end a war. And they have to be reasonable conditions, right? Not crazy stuff. If you're interested in peace, that's what you do. If you're not interested in peace, then you sort of drag it out and you come up with excuses and you pull, and we know that, and we're not going to get pulled into that. But let's hope it doesn't come to that. Let's hope, let's be optimistic that's not the direction we're going. We're prepared if it is, but let's hope that we're not heading in a direction of this is just a delay tactic.
All right, one more and then we wrap up.
Don't you guys want to go home, the ones that came with us?
Your allies here and also Ukraine, they believe that Russia is actually preparing for another, to launch another campaign, a military campaign, as soon as the winter season ends. Do you have any reason to doubt that?
That they're going to do what? I'm sorry?
The Russians are preparing to start another military campaign.
Well, then we'll know they're not interested in peace.
And at this very moment, they're targeting energy sites. Can I get a reaction to that?
They're targeting what? I'm so sorry?
Energy sites in Ukraine.
Well, again, this is, I get it. Then that means they're violating the ceasefire. That's not a good sign, you know, but I think that would tell you this, that ultimately this is a war right now. Things are going to be blowing up in Ukraine and inside of Russia because there's still a war going on. That's what we're trying to end. Okay, if we have a true ceasefire, which is what we wanted, a complete ceasefire, nothing should be blowing up. But the Russians didn't agree to that. They wanted a partial. And then obviously when you get into these partials, that's one of the reasons why we didn't push for a partial. We'll take it because it's better than nothing. But one of the reasons why we didn't push for a partial, because there's always disputes about what are you hitting and what you're not hitting. But in the end, this is still a war, and we want it to stop. The fact that religious sites are being hit, or energy sites are being hit, or civilian sites are being hit, that's why war is a bad thing, and that's why the president wants to end it. As far as them conducting another campaign, well, then that'll be a very clear sign, right? If all of a sudden we wake up tomorrow and the Russians are launching a massive offensive, then I think that's a pretty clear sign they're not interested in peace. That hasn't happened yet. Let's hope it doesn't happen. We want to know whether they want to do peace or not. And if they do, then there's a way there, and we're willing to help. If they're not, then it's good to know early so we can adjust our policies accordingly.
All right, everybody. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.